So I want to talk, go on to talk a little bit about the survey and what we saw. And Stephanie, in general, what we saw in the investigators, in general, right now, there's in general, multi-gene panels are favored in terms of germline testing. Looks like almost everybody is doing multi-gene somatic. But where it gets interesting, I think, is HRD testing. So Stephanie, in general, and I'm just putting reimbursement issues aside because, you know, every country is a little bit sort of putting reimbursement issues aside. If you sort of get into the clinical science, what do you think is the optimal strategy, assuming the patient has no family history, for a patient presenting with ovarian cancer nowadays, Stephanie?
I think as we discuss, with Katie just discussed, I think the germline testing is very important because actually have impact for the patient, but also the family. And we talk a lot about the BRCA, but I think the panel is really probably the way to go because we begin to know that there's a lot of mutation beyond BRCA that are important, and we can cite PRBA2, RAD51. All these genes may have an impact, and I think prevention really still need to be our focus. So I think the germline testing with the panel is very important. In terms of the somatic testing, I'm glad that you say that it's regulation apart. I think the HRD testing may have some importance given we may have different benefit, but we don't know yet what is really the value of the HRD testing. Each institution may have their own HRD testing as well. We all the trial use the same HRD testing, but actually we know that did not select all the population. So we were just talking about the fact that, you know, somatic BRCA, we may miss 5%, but again, for the HRD testing, we miss much more than 5% of the patient may have benefit because the test is not completely accurate. So I think it's why the approval from FDA was regardless the HRD status, because right now the test can help to guide the treatment and the discussion with the patient, but are not completely sensitive and specific.
So we're going to actually get into some cases. There are a lot of questions about what do you do if they're HRD positive, negative. We'll actually see that played out in terms of some of these questions. We'll also want to show you kind of the way the docs in practice, what they're doing. And you can see in general, it's pretty similar, maybe a little bit more BRCA germline than panel than in the investigators, but a lot of use of NGS. And Joyce, you know, again, you see a minority of people using the HRD assay. Your talk was really fantastic. I highly recommend people to go through Joyce's talk. One of the things you get into, Joyce, that I didn't realize was that HRD is like a, you call it a state, but that's not exactly what is being measured. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, Stephanie was alluding to this as well. I mean, HRD is really a state of the cell. Your cell can either repair DNA double-strand breaks by homologous recombination deficiency or it can't. Like, that's true or not true. But all of our tests of HR deficiency right now, they're all sort of basically proxy tests. We're trying to guess what the true state of the cell is, and that state actually changes. So our tests aren't good. And I think that's why I totally agree with the statement that HRD testing right now gives us guidance. It might help you give guidance to a patient, but it's not a definitive yes or no. It's not like BRCA mutation. You know it's mutated or you know it's not. We can't directly test HRD right now.
And of course, like all assays in oncology, it has to be individualized to the patient. You know, is it going to really make a difference to what you do or not? That would have to be considered. Rob, you had a thought?
Yeah, I was going to say, to Joyce's statement, I think the analogy I always use is the smoke and fire. So the fire being HRD is being the homologous recombination. Smoke meaning that there's you know it was there at some point, and smoke can linger even though the fire may be out. So it's not specific enough to actually tell you, although it can potentially represent the incident.
I have to say, when I did the interview with Rob, he said, "Oh, I'm going to send you a couple papers to try to explain what I'm telling you about." He sent me these two papers. I have no idea, Rob. I have no idea what those papers said. Just so you know.
I'm trying.
I'm glad somebody understands it, but it's not me. Anyhow, another issue, Stephanie. I wanted your thoughts on. You know, we hear about other germline mutations. We can go to the next slide here. And we asked our investigators, what about PALB2, RAD51C, and ATM? Now, sort of along the lines of, you know, what our questioner said, is it really relevant? But assuming you do want to know it, Stephanie, it looks like the faculty in general is kind of approaching these three germline mutations similarly to BRCA. Is that the way you approach them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think definitely. I think because BRCA, it's really well defined. And then after this BRCA-like, or what we call the HRD deficiency, is actually the difficulty to repair the DNA. And all these genes are involved in this repair of the homologous repair deficiency. So I think when we try to define the HRD, I think these genes are really in the pathway. So actually it makes completely sense to define them and treat them, consider as HRD deficiency.
So another question that we asked related to, as we go through this, we're going to bring up a few issues related to COVID, social distancing, et cetera. Katie, one of the questions we had was, is your approach to genetic counseling changing? And you can see that investigators in general say yes. And of course, when you ask them how it's changing, and the first thing everybody brings up nowadays is telehealth and telemedicine, et cetera. We saw that same thing in our docs in practice. Any comments about how you approach? I always thought, Katie, that we maybe should have used technology more in genetic counseling anyhow, you know, telemedicine, videos, et cetera. How's your approach to genetic counseling, Katie, changed, if at all? I know your area is not as affected as other areas, but in the last few weeks or a couple months, Katie.
Right. So we are very fortunate in Oklahoma to have been spared for the most part. So we've sort of been kind of business as usual. We have used more telehealth, and our patients who are frightened very much appreciate that. And so that's true for genetic counseling as well. So it hasn't tremendously shifted. Most of our visits are still in person, but maybe for a month we were using more telehealth. But I think we are going to keep telehealth because a lot of our patients really like it, and it is very helpful because now we couldn't bill before in my institution for telehealth. And so now all of a sudden we can do consults and we can do all of these things and actually bill. And so that's really helpful for our genetic counselors who are already underpaid, but they can do some more telehealth visits and see patients really on schedule. And there's been nice work from across the US. The West Clinic in Memphis has shown this, and you know, other institutions, I think any of us could rattle those off, have really demonstrated that this is a very effective way to appropriately counsel families about genetic risk. And so this epidemic, which is terrible on every level, there are some silver linings, and a lot of our institutions had rapidly do things that we've always wanted to do, like telemedicine and reducing unnecessary visits and clinical trials. I could go on that are going to stay, and I think will benefit our patients tremendously. And telehealth is one of them. Genetic counseling, pre-chemo visits, blah, so many things.